Hello. You are listening to the hashtag STR Ask podcast, where we answer the questions that you send to us via Twitter using that tag, hashtag STR Ask. I'm John Noyes, and I am not Amy Hall. I wish I were Amy Hall sometimes, but I am not. And I get the opportunity to sit in her place and fill in here for her with Greg Kokel. How you doing, Greg?
Morning, John. Doing all right. Finally waking up a bit.
Nice. And are you just ready to dive into some questions?
Sure. Let's go.
All right. The first one comes from Clive, and he asks, he's asking you, Greg, I have a question. How to deal with a person who steamrolls, there's no proof of God?
Well, a steamroller is somebody who continually interrupts. And so I'm not sure if that's exactly what Clive means here by the situation. But I presume then, if taking the question at face value, this is about someone. It doesn't matter what you say to them. They're just going to keep repeating, there's no proof for God. There's no proof for God. No proof for... Every time you try to say something, they jump in, but there's no proof for God. So they have decided in advance, it looks like to me, that there is no proof for God, and therefore there's no reason for anyone, any Christian, to finish out his comments, his argument, or maybe even his sentence. It's like saying, you're wasting my time trying to give me proofs when I know there is no proof. Now, of course, you can see this is narrow-minded. This person has blinders on. If a person thinks there is no proof and someone is willing to offer him something to consider as decisive evidence for God, then they ought to be willing to listen if they care about that kind of thing. But if they dismiss the evidence before it's even offered because they have decided in advance that there could be no such thing as proof for God, well, that's a prejudicial view. They have prejudged the circumstances and can offer, and therefore they're not willing to listen at all, okay? So there are some questions here that I think are entirely appropriate. And one might be, what do you mean? Oh, well, there's no proof for God. What do you mean? So now I want clarification. And that's our first Columbo question, of course. And it's the simplest question to roll off your tongue in just about any situation. Let's gather more information about their concern. Now, they could answer in many different ways. But notice when you've asked them a question and they are answering, they're not interrupting themselves. They're certainly not interrupting you. Yeah. That's the steamroller. Now they get to talk, okay? But the talk that they give, hopefully, will be directed in a productive way because of the question you've asked. And this is just another illustration about how when you use questions, it puts you in the driver's seat of the conversation, directing it at least initially where you want it to go. And I think if a steamroller type person, a belligerent kind of atheist, and I'm not saying all atheists are belligerent, but some are, and this would be, at least as we've talked about it, an example of one, that person is going to be happy to tell you, it seems to me, what they mean by there is no proof. Now, here is something to be aware of, though. If you ask the question, what do you mean, when somebody says there is no proof, they are very likely to simply repeat themselves. I'm saying there is no proof. Well, I know I heard that, but I'm not exactly sure what you mean. Now, what they may mean is there is no evidence that anyone has come up with, as opposed to any evidence anyone can give me that would be decisive. They say there's no evidence anyone can give me that could be decisive. That's just a way of reaffirming their prejudicial notion and their closed-mindedness. I'm not listening to anybody. But that's not, obviously, an intellectual virtue. And it might, if they put it that way, you might ask for clarification. Are you saying that it doesn't matter what anyone tells you, you will not consider it as possible? And then see what they say. It might not be what they meant by putting it that way, but I suspect often it is. They might just say, though, they've never seen any evidence that seems to be compelling. Okay. And so here's, I'm going to give a series of kinds of questions that you can ask in the circumstance. That was one of them. What do you mean by that? Get a clarification when they say there is no proof. And what they might mean is that there is no evidence that is so convincing that everyone will be convinced. And the answer to that is you're right. But is that what is required to say that you have proven something? All right. And I mean, there are people who think that Elvis is still alive, for goodness sake, or John Kennedy is still alive. So there's not, you know, requiring evidence that is so compelling that no one will gainsay it is a little bit over the top. Right? No one will deny it. It's a little bit over the top. So you can challenge the reasonableness of that standard. The fact is, your friend who you're talking to actually believes all kinds of controversial things, it turns out, with much less justification than absolute apodictic certainty. 2 + 2 = 4. Well, you can pretty much count on that one. That's apodictic, you know, impossible to be mistaken. Although there are some people who disagree with that. So you're always going to be able to find somebody to disagree. So you want to know what their standards for proof happen to be. And that's what the questions are going to be. So the questions can be worded in different ways. You're trying to figure out from the person, what exactly do you mean by proof? What are your standards for proof? Are you asking for proof, apodictic certainty, like I just described? Certainty that cannot be denied, that's pretty high. Are you asking for beyond a reasonable doubt? That's all that's required to hang a person in states that that have capital punishment. I mean, that sounds like a pretty solid standard, even though it's not perfect. Okay. The preponderance of evidence, that's like 51%. That's civil cases, not criminal cases. So what is it? What are your standards? And do you apply those standards to all the important questions? So these are the things you can press the other person on to see if they're being fair. You might also ask them, what are some of the alleged proofs that you've considered that you find wanting? Now, if they say, well, I've never seen anything like that, we say, well, the literature is full of them. How do you know there is no proof about God, for God, if you haven't read, if you've not taken a look at the alleged proofs? See, that's another question. Okay. Now, if they say, well, yeah, I did check them out. Well, okay, which one did you check out? Well, the cosmological arguments, the teleological arguments, the moral arguments, the arguments of history, the arguments of the life of Jesus, the arguments based on the resurrection. I mean, help me out. You know, which ones did you consider? And if they say, well, I thought about this or that, they say, what did you find wrong with it? Okay, now notice what we've done is we have shifted the whole direction of the conversation. We start out with a steamroller who's just putting us down with every single thing that we say, interrupting and blowing us off, dismissing us aggressively. And so now what? Okay, he's in the driver's seat. We don't have anything to say. Nobody's listening. Well, this is easy to fix. You just use your tactical game plan, begin asking questions pertaining to the statements that he's made. To claim that there is no evidence for God or no proof is a bit of a controversial claim in light of the history of the work that's been done, all the way back to the almost to the time of Jesus. But you can think notably of people like Thomas Aquinas and C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer and, you know, a whole bunch of moderns and writers who have advanced standard kinds of arguments. William Lane Craig, you, me, Alan Schliemann, Tim Barnett, and Ravi Zacharias, the host of them, all right? So, okay, with that record on the table, all right, well, what's wrong with them? Which ones have you thought about? What's wrong? What are your standards for being confident you can know something? And are you using that standard consistently with all the important things you know are true? Now, I think this kind of questioning is important because my suspicion is that the atheist is being intellectually dishonest with the challenge, because they don't hold anything else to the kind of standard for truth that they are holding questions about God. And if they say, well, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, well, I'm just going to turn that back on them. I don't think that statement is true, by the way, but I'm just going to turn that back on them. All right, well, you've just made an extraordinary claim. You claim there is no God. Yeah. and 98% of the people think you're wrong. So that makes it a little bit odd. And what is your evidence that there is no God? What is your proof that there is no God? Now, that's a little bit of a turnabout. And I personally don't think it's necessary to prove a universal negative, like there can't be anywhere in the universe a God, something like that. And some Christians have pressed that issue. But I still think that they have some obligation to give some evidence. And if they're making an opposing statement, and it's either God or not God, one or the other, and if they reject the first, then they affirm the second. But if affirming something controversial, like there is no God, requires proof, then where's their proof? So you just play their standards against them.
That's fantastic. The next question that we have is from Robert Wall. Role-playing with another Christian, he flatly states that matter itself can't be self-existing because it can change from matter to energy, and self-existing things can't change. Is this unchangeability assumption philosophically and or rationally valid in your view?
Well, I read this question over a couple of times, and of course, this is what's being advanced here is an argument for theism. That is, if only the material world, say matter, energy, exist, then that would mean that they are the ground of existence because it would have to be eternal. Unless you want to assert that they just popped into existence out of nothing for no reason, but that's utterly implausible. So one could say, well, the universe always existed. Many thinkers in the past until the 20th century believed that was the case. Now science has weighed in to the contrary. But, you know, if you want to say that, well, then you would have to say that the ground of existence is in matter and energy itself. That's why it is self-existence. It exists based on some quality inherent to itself, what is classically called aseity, which is self-existence. And this is attributed to God, of course, and with good reason. But I think that if a person wants to make this argument, they are demonstrating that they are asserting that the. And let me back up again. I use the word argument. It's not an argument. It's an assertion at this point that the universe is eternal and therefore it must be self-existing. Okay, I get that. And therefore it is not contingent on anything else for its existence. Okay? And I think the way the Christian is going here is when you look at the universe, it evidences characteristics of contingency. For one, it could change from one thing to another. Matter can change to energy according to the equation that Einstein offered, E equal MC squared. That's the equation for that kind of thing. Energy equals mass times speed of light to the square. So there is an interactive relationship between these two. Now, I don't want to press the philosophical point too far because I'm out of my depth at this point. But my suspicion is he's right, that if the thing is mutable, that indicates its contingency, and if it's contingent, it is not self-existent. If it owes its existence to nothing more than its own ontology, then it's hard to think about how it could change from one type of physical thing to another type of physical thing, matter to energy, so to speak. So I think it sounds to me like there's a point here. The point is somewhat esoteric. In other words, it's a bit complex and maybe hard for a lot of people to follow, and I think there's an easier way to make this point, and that is just an appeal to science that almost universally agrees that for good reason, by the way. It's not just a universal agreement. You look at the reasons. That's the Rhodes Scholar tactic. For good reason that the universe came into existence at some point in the distance past through a singularity that has come to be known as the Big Bang. Now, Christians don't like the Big Bang. A lot of them don't, but that's because of the age of the earth issue. just the notion, the bare notion of the Big Bang, though, fits perfectly with Genesis 1:1. It fits our story. It doesn't fit people's interpretation of the age of the universe, but it fits our story, the event. So I'm not troubled by it at all. And so because of what science has weighed in on, it's hard to assert that the universe is the ultimate. The universe has aseity or self-existence. And so there's no need to go into more esoteric or highfalutin, philosophically highfalutin notions of the aseity of matter and how that's possible and impossible because it changes and can change, where a lot of people aren't just going to follow it. They don't follow it, it's not going to be persuasive. So I think what's more persuasive along the same line is the evidence that the universe is not eternal. It came into existence. Everybody, Christians and non-Christians, agree to that. And as I put it, hey, a Big Bang needs a Big Banger. Come on. There's the cosmological argument, or at least one form of the cosmological argument, in shorthand for you. And I think that's much more accessible. So though it looks like I would agree in principle with the argument as offered, I don't think it's helpful because it's too complex. It's too hard to understand for the average person. Even the Christian who is hearing it from the other Christian isn't getting it and is wondering whether it's sound or not. So that's not a good sign.
Yeah. I think that's that's right on. I'm gonna skip down one question here because we've got maybe 4 minutes left, but I think we could answer this one. Do you think the mechanics of the creation of the rainbow did not naturally exist before God put it in the sky for Noah?
You know, this is a really clever question, and I have never been asked it before, but I have thought about this myself because we know how rainbows work. There's a prismatic effect of the small droplets of water in rain that when the sun strikes them in a very particular way, divides out the light. The light is divided out into a spectrum, and then we can see it displayed as this magnificent rainbow. Well, that's a function of physics. And are we to understand that something about the way light works as refracted from a prism was created at that moment? That strikes me as unnecessarily complex. So I'm going to go with Occam's razor here, and I'm not going to magnify details or causes when another more simplified explanation will do. I actually read this text yesterday when I saw, anticipating this question. It's in Genesis 9, 12 through 17. And it doesn't say, on my take of the wording, it does not say that God created rainbows in general at that moment. He said he put the bow in the sky. Okay? He put the bow in the sky and as a sign. Now, when you think about biblical signs, circumcision is a sign. God required of the Jews in virtue of the Abrahamic covenant to circumcise, but that wasn't the first time circumcision was even done. The Egyptians did it before that. And so it was an existing behavior that was that was co-opted by God to give new spiritual significance to it. The sign of the new covenant is baptism. Or maybe the Lord's Supper. In either case, how people take it, these are still things that happened beforehand that have been instituted in a special way for a particular reason to add meaning to it. It could very well have been that rainbows existed before, but what God does is when he makes this promise, he then, as the text says, put the bow in the sky, and he said, boom, there it is. See that thing right there? That thing is a sign now of my covenant never to destroy the earth with water again. And I think that's a perfectly adequate explanation with that makes sense of the text and doesn't require the laws of physics to be somehow altered when the rainbow was presented by God as a sign.
Fantastic. And with that rainbow answer, we are finished here on this episode of Hashtag STR.
We are at the end.
And I want to remind everybody that keeps sending in your questions to us via Twitter. We love getting them. This is John Noyes with Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.